Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak with Anthony Parnther. Anthony Parnther is a conductor and a bassoonist whose work ranges from leading major symphony orchestras and sold-out Carnegie Hall premieres to collaborating with artists like Joshua Bell and Jesse Norman and Wu-Tang Clan and Rihanna. One of today's foremost film conductors, he has also led scoring sessions for landmark projects including Oppenheimer, Encanto, The Mandalorian, Black Panther Wakanda Forever, and Avatar The Way of Water. On Saturday, January 24th, and Sunday, January 25th, he'll be in Buffalo conducting the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra for the program Mozart's Concerto. Tickets are available at bpo.org and in the show notes. In this interview, we speak about education, rare instruments, the genre of the orchestra, and the program at the BPO. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Anthony Parnther. Anthony Parnther, thank you so much for speaking with me today. How are you?
Oh, I am great. I'm going to be boarding a plane to Buffalo in about an hour, so
we'll make it quick then.
Oh, no, we're good.
Good. So I always like to start these interviews by asking, is there a story from your youth that connects to what you do now?
Well, okay. So my whole getting into music was kind of a plot or scam or scheme, if you will, to get on roller coasters.
Okay.
I'm from Virginia originally. I wanted to go to King's Dominion, which was the somewhat local theme park where, you know, they had all the great roller coaster rides. And in the eighth grade, I heard over the intercom what all the students in the Lincoln Middle School band report to the bus for their trip to King's Dominion. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if this is a school trip, then my parents will let me go. So I opened the dictionary, I turned to the A section of the dictionary, and I saw a picture of the accordion. And for those of us of a certain age, that reminded me of Lawrence Welk and the Lawrence Welk Show. And I thought that that was extremely nerdy. So I wanted to play an instrument that would accord the respect of my peers. So I turned to the B section of the dictionary and saw this picture of a bassoon, not realizing that it might be the only instrument competitive with the accordion as far as nerdiness is concerned. And I chose that as my weapon of choice to join the band program so I could go on the roller coaster rides. Now, here's the twist of the story, is that they had gone on this trip for years and years and years sequentially. But when I joined the band, they stopped going to King's Dominion. So I never got to go on the trip. But it's resulted in quite an interesting career in music.
Wow. Well, the bassoon is a very special instrument. And although you won't be playing it with the BPO upcoming, you are the conductor, and we'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to ask about the bassoon. What made you stay with it? I'm sure it's a very, very difficult instrument to play. And there's always that moment, I think, in a young musician's life where they hit the wall and keep going or stop. What made you hit the wall and keep going?
Well, I think I really enjoyed the community atmosphere of, you know, sort of communal music making. Hmm. For my first year, I was the only bassoonist. And then when I got to high school, there was two of us. I don't know, it was kind of unique. It was pretty special. You know, we had a big band program, but we did not have a bunch of bassoon players. So I felt kind of special. And then, you know, we have these little things called the all district tryouts where you get to meet bassoon players from other schools. And I don't know, just thought it was fascinating, especially from the community atmosphere. And then I started to get pretty good at the thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is why I think research proves to be so interesting. I'm going to ask a question here. And if you don't want to answer it, we can absolutely skip over it. But I want to speak to you about your education. When I looked at your bio and sort of the amazing accomplishments that you've had in your life, I just said, oh, probably went to Juilliard. Terrible, right? Terrible that I thought that. But you actually started off at East Tennessee State University. And then you went to Yale afterwards. But I think sometimes, even from my silly assumption, right, that we can look and say, oh, this person has to go to Juilliard to sort of
accomplished great things. Not to say that Juilliard's a great school or whatever, but I'm just interested if you can maybe talk about, I don't know, the experience at East Tennessee State University and how it prepared you for the career that you have now going to a state school.
Oh, it was amazing. This was an opportunity, first of all, I think one of the first things that it gave me the opportunity to do was to go out and teach, because, you know, sort of part of the culture, especially in that region, was is that almost all of the music students went out and taught in the local school programs and so forth. So I got a lot of opportunity to teach, to conduct. The ensembles were great. I got to do a lot of singing and playing and so forth. So it was a really, honestly, I thought it was a remarkable experience in so many ways. And it, you know, and reflecting back on my experience there, it really prepared me in ways that were really crucial to my development as a musician and a conductor.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering that. I also want to sort of stay on your bio for a second and saying that it says you specialize in some not so common woodwind instruments like the sarrusophone and the heckelphone. And if I'm mispronouncing the names of them, please let me know, because I've just never seen them before. Can you tell us a little bit about these instruments?
Well, you know, for the last, you know, nearly 20 years, I've been working in Hollywood as a studio musician, and bassoon is my focus, but I actually do play all the wind instruments. So if you've ever watched some cartoons like, you know, American Dad or The Simpsons or things along those lines, you'll actually hear me playing a variety of wind instruments. But every once in a while, a composer is looking for a sound that is outside of the normal orchestral spectrum. And I have a lot of wind instruments in my studio downstairs. And, you know, so I have pulled out a sarrusophone. Sarrusophone is kind of like a saxophone and a contrabassoon got married and had children. It's like a metal, large double reed instrument that produces a fairly gnarly sound. So I have played that on a number of video game soundtracks. And then the heckelphone is kind of like an overgrown oboe. You know, the oboe comes in different sizes. There's the regular oboe. There's the oboe d'amore, which is just a little larger. There's the English horn and the bass oboe. But basically, the heckelphone is a large bore bass oboe. And I have played that on a number of movies and television shows. And it really, it's an unusual sound that the ear can't pinpoint quite so quickly. And I found that composers are really drawn to its unique qualities.
Wow. Fantastic. Could you talk to us a little bit about being both a performer and a conductor and music director? What inspired you to be a conductor, and how is the position different than being a performer?
For me, I, as a conductor, am suspicious of people who pick up the baton but don't have a master of their own instrument, because I'm thinking to myself, on what authority do you have to tell someone what to do with their instrument if you haven't had a, you know, a representative level of achievement on your own instrument? So I have found that the conductors that I tend to be drawn to themselves were great performers. You know, Leonard Bernstein didn't put down the piano when he, you know, moved into conducting. In fact, he kept them up rather equably throughout his career. So to me, being a musician, a well-rounded musician, was always sort of in my primary focus. And then, you know, sometimes you are a conductor, sometimes you're an orchestrator, sometimes you are composing, sometimes you're teaching, sometimes you're, you know, so it's all sort of a symbiotic relationship. And, you know, I was playing my bassoon yesterday at a recording session, and tomorrow I'll be rehearsing Mozart. So it's all sort of, I think they're important to keep up.
Fantastic. You've collaborated with artists ranging from Joshua Bell to Jesse Norman to the Wu-Tang Clan and Rihanna. How do you adapt your approach as a conductor when moving between genres or working with different artists?
I wouldn't have it any other way. I don't love the idea of specializing in music. I think good music is good music, and I'm interested in putting on a great show regardless of the genre. And that's the magic of the orchestra, is that the orchestra is genreless and it can do anything. So, you know, working with RZA from Wu-Tang Clan on a Chipotle commercial one day to conducting a Brooke concerto the next week with Joshua Bell is all just part of what makes for an interesting landscape. And I like being able to shapeshift within the music industry. So I absolutely wouldn't have it any other way.
I love what you just said there. And you really kind of cracked my brain open when you said the orchestra is genreless, because I think sometimes people think of an orchestra being only, they sort of group it with kind of the idea of classical music, which usually means romantic music, right? It doesn't necessarily mean classical music, but that's such an incredible way of thinking about an orchestra and the music that it can create. Can you speak a little bit more on that? Like, when was that said to you? Is that something that you sort of came to the conclusion yourself? Like, I'm just so interested by that phrase.
Well, I think it just came from my own lived experiences. You know, here I am playing bassoon in a, you know, in an orchestra, and then I get called to play, you know, on a on a rap album, and then the next week I'm being asked to play on a rock album, and then the next week I'm, you know, I'm playing, you know, bassoon in experimental jazz and avant-garde music. So just over the course of time, I'm realizing, oh, wait a minute, the orchestra isn't just consigned to, you know, Wagner and Tchaikovsky and, you know, and Beethoven. It can do so much more if we allow it to. And that's, and I think that's part of the magic of this kind of music making.
This weekend marks your first time conducting the BPO on a classic series after previous Pops appearances. What's exciting about making that classics debut with this orchestra this weekend?
Well, I think the repertoire comes to the forefront. Now, as a bassoonist, the Haffner Symphony, which is the 35th symphony by Mozart, has been, for some bassoonists, it is a terror to play because it requires quite a bit of technical wizardry in order to accomplish, especially depending on what kind of mood the conductor is in. because the piece is quite difficult to play, but if the conductor has had a cup of coffee, then it becomes even more difficult to play because the tempi become quite fast. But I'm really looking forward to conducting the Haffner Symphony. That's really sort of the core focus of this, alongside the fifth concerto, the Turkish concerto. And then, of course, alongside these two staples of the repertoire, we're performing the music of two composers who deserve to be showcased a little more often. And that is the Second Symphony by Joseph Bologna and this really charming little opera overture by Maria Theresia Vamperidi.
Were you involved at all in setting the program for the upcoming concert? Or I know that sometimes like the BPO is really known for its like incredible programming. And I love to just ask, in case our listeners want a little kind of behind the scenes look, did you participate in kind of choosing the pieces? Was it given to you? How did the program come together?
This was a collaboration. I actually had some conversations with the legendary music director, Maestro Joanne Folletta, in selecting this program. And she had some wonderful ideas. I think that I chose, we knew that we needed a Mozart symphony. There's many of them to choose from. So Haffner was definitely something that I came up with. And then I believe, you know, because at this time of year, I believe they do an annual Mozart festival. So we knew that Mozart was going to be the central theme. She had already selected this Turkish concerto, the fifth concerto by Mozart for the violin. And then the Bologna and the Parody sort of fell in by both of our sort of collaborative thoughts on putting this this fun program together.
Great. Is there something that you might kind of point out or some sort of insider moment that you might kind of point to in one of the pieces for our listeners to kind of be aware of or listen for?
Well, sure. Well, you know, I keep referring to this fifth concerto as the Turkish concerto. The reason for that is that, you know, back in those days, in the, you know, late 1700s, composers were looking for new sounds to incorporate in the orchestra. So they turned to the percussion section. So, you know, this means cymbals and drums, big drums, small drums, tambourines, things along those lines. And these were reminiscent of the Janissary bands from the Ottoman Empire, now known as Turkey, of course. And so in this concerto, the string players are asked to do some unusual things, especially for the late 1700s, that felt ultra contemporary at the time, such as, you know, the string players are using the wooden side of the bow on the string as opposed to the string side of the bow, which gives it an impressive effect. And, you know, also some of the ways that Mozart facilitated the harmonies were unusual for music of that time, and it was reminiscent of something quite exotic. So that would be sort of like an interesting insight there. And of course, Bologna is an extraordinary individual, also known as the Chevalier de Saint-Georges. He is credited as one of our earliest Black composers of Western classical music. And I mean, if you think it's rare today to see, a Black composer, how rare do you think it would have been in the 1700s? So this is a contemporary of Mozart, who was just unbelievably extraordinary in so many ways. And in addition to being an accomplished violin soloist and conductor and composer, he was also an amazing athlete and swordsman and so many other things. And of course, they had a movie just a few years ago, Chevalier, about this extraordinary individual. And then, of course, we have Maria Theresia von Parodi, who was a student of Salieri, who some people view as a rival of Mozart. But she was a blind singer and pianist who made her way all throughout Europe. And she actually helped found a school for the blind that Louis Braille, who invented the Braille system that's still used today, attended. So, I mean, these are just three extraordinary individuals, and it'll be interesting to approach this music through these three, lenses that are quite different, but we're living at the same time.
Wow, what an incredible program. My final question is, sometimes for a variety of reasons, people can think that orchestral music and the experience of attending a place like the BPO might not be for them. What might you say to someone who might not think that orchestral music might not be their thing or is for them?
Oh, that's changed so much. I think that people would be surprised to learn that, you know, going to an orchestra concert is as inexpensive as it is, considering that, you know, when you go and see some artists on stage, it might be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people on stage. In the Buffalo Philharmonic's case, it might be, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 or more people on stage. But it's A, it's very affordable. B, it's quite casual. And C, it's a lot of fun. So, I mean, I have two rules for any orchestra concert, and they are 1, to learn something, and 2, to have fun. Mm. If I haven't done that, then we're not doing our job.
Fantastic. My goodness. Well, that was an extraordinary interview. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with me. I always like to end by asking my guests, is there anything that you feel was left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our listeners? And if the answer is no, that's okay. But I always like to leave the door open in case there's something that I missed.
Oh, I would say that, you know, sometimes it's really cool to actually, you know, go on to your streaming service of choice, maybe Apple Music, which is mine, and give like a brief little listen to the pieces before you go into the concert hall to give you a new perspective on the possibilities of the work. But if not, then it's always, of course, more than welcome to experience these works for the first time, up close and personal. We look forward to seeing you there.
Great. Thank you so much. Anthony Parther, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Anthony Parther. On Saturday, January 24th, and Sunday, January 25th, he'll be in Buffalo conducting the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra for the program Mozart's Concerto. Tickets are available at bpo.org and in the show notes. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Sarah Potter engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.